This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 29th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 212th edition of the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck and Sophie Grove.
On the show today, we'll be heading through the gilded halls of power in China to find out why the authorities in Beijing have banned the construction of new government buildings across the country, claiming that they've become too lavish. We'll speak to the architect behind some of those buildings here in the studio.
We'll also head to the Irish capital, to the Festival of Curiosity, and find out why poking your nose into other people's business may actually be good for your brain.
And the pen may well be mightier than the sword. Do our inky etchings reflect our personality?
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards will be here with news for the week ahead. And of course, we'll fit in some tunes too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Revolving tables, revolving chairs. Well, we've got revolving chairs, that's for sure. So Sophie is with me this week.
Hello.
I'm in the seat that Rob normally sits in. And in honour of that, I have on some very bright strides.
You do. You look fabulous. You're channeling Rob.
I've got bright blue strides on. He normally has green or red.
The other day he had a pink T-shirt and green. He looked like a watermelon man.
The other day he came to work, I think, dressed for a nightclub. He had on a pair of short shorts, which I think he'd borrowed off somebody. I'm not sure of which gender, and a very strange T-shirt. But anyway.
He may well have come straight from a nightclub, knowing Rob.
Anyway, Mr. Bound isn't here this week. He's missed, but I'm very glad to say that I've got Sophie Grove. Now, Sophie, lots of interesting things. One, Monocle on Med is on newsstands.
Very fun. We had a party to launch it earlier this week.
And what have you got in there?
Well, I went to Geneva to go on some yachts
and
take the temperature of the Italian economy at the same time. And I've also got a little rant in the form of an essay about why you shouldn't wreck your holiday by taking too many snaps.
Good. And I hear that's been popular with other media channels already.
Yeah.
You've been picked up.
I've been picked up. People have been reading it. It's seen as something of a manifesto for photography on holiday by a few people who've contacted me. And I'm glad. I'm setting the agenda. Well, at least people are maybe going to stop paparazzing themselves on holiday, which is the topic of the piece. And what have you got in there, Andrew?
I've got an essay about why it's good not to be adventurous when you go on holiday. How about that? Just do the same thing. No, they're saying that actually sometimes, of course, you want to go to Ouagadougou or wherever you say it for your holidays, but other times you want to go back to the same place you've been before. So it's all about celebrating repetition.
It's lovely.
And the other good news is that the book is coming out, the Monocle book. And I think 2 days ago, I suddenly saw the proofs from the printers. So I think we're going to get copies sometime in late August, and it's on newsstand in September. But amazingly, we offered to our subscribers the first, 500 of a special edition of the book, which is numbered, slightly different cover. And they all sold out within 3 days. I think there's like two or three left.
Gosh.
That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, it is good.
Thank you, subscribers.
Yeah,
that's what we say.
Thank you. And it's very good, too, the book itself. So lucky them.
Yes. Anyway, well, that's what we've been doing here at Midori House in London. But enough of the week gone by and enough of Sophie shuffling her pieces of paper. We'll be looking at the week ahead next with Tom Edwards.
And now, from London, Camden's king of current affairs, the man who put the eek into Monocle Weekly, the ooh into the news. He once wrestled an angry mongoose. He doesn't sleep. He waits. He's about to open a can of whoop-ass on your week. And it's not even Monday. Undefeated, unflappable, and pretty much unheard of outside of digital radio, it's Monocle 24's news editor, Mr. Tom Edwards.
Oh, how good is that? I haven't heard that for a few weeks.
That really does warm the cockles.
Can I ask you a shopping question?
Fire away.
Where do you buy cans of whoop-ass?
They're available at all good retailers.
Do they do family packs?
Absolutely. I'm surprised you haven't seen our own Monocle 24 limited edition whoop-ass. Available at monocle.com.
Are you signing the tins of whoop-ass?
I personally oversee each and every individual Cannes distribution.
Sophie, has Tom offered you any whoopass?
He hasn't, sadly.
I hear he's got plenty of it. So anyway.
That's Tom. Right.
Should we try and transition into global news now?
It's going to be extremely difficult.
From whoopass to global news.
I've got a few interesting stories. Let's start with the Middle East. I mean, there's supposedly going to be a resumption of peace talks, potentially this week, could be happening on Tuesday, if parties can get back around the table. Frankly, it's hard to know what to expect. But Israel, Palestinian territories, it's been almost 3 years, the talks have been frozen out. But there does seem to be some kind of general momentum behind them. The US has got involved. And there's, I think, a sense of faint optimism that something may actually happen this week.
I was going to say, what's interesting is, I guess it is because the Americans suddenly seem to be quite keen on seeing some progress finally, that you just see some momentum. And it's incredible that you need an outside partner to come in and kind of say, okay, let's get back around the table for something to happen.
Well, absolutely. And the thing is, it doesn't almost just take that. They need to really have conviction behind it. And I think it generally helps in second-term US presidential administrations because, we've said this before, they can play the statesman, they can actually invest a bit more, both in terms of time and in terms of finances and in terms of kind of political capital to try and make something happen. So we should keep a close eye on it this week. And who knows, maybe there'll be some, even gradual progress would represent something to perhaps celebrate.
Nevertheless, those talks are always so painstaking and slow. I mean, Mitchell, who was overseeing the previous ones, and Tony Blair, who's involved with the quartet, they say that it's just one of the most soul-destroying jobs, trying to inch this progress along, and it falls off the wagon. Well, people fall off so often at the smallest nuance, and in a way that it's a small hope that this could get up and running with Kerry's sort of intervention.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think he seems to have done a fairly sort of sound job. I don't know if he's a great unifying figure, but I think he is inoffensive enough to enough people that it could spark something. And as you say, even once it starts moving, the pace can be dreadfully slow. But you know, let's hope this.
And we should quickly reference a previous guest on here, who was the filmmaker behind The Gatekeepers, which is this amazing film about Shin Bet, which looked at kind of what the kind of these custodians of, you know, Israel's security felt looking back over 40 years, what happened in Israel. And you've just got the sense that actually even people who had fighting the Palestinians, who had been there to kind of, you know, stop terrorist attacks, they also felt there'd been so many kind of missed opportunities. So it's amazing when you see some of the kind of the fathers of the state of Israel saying, actually, in the end, you're going to have to start talking.
What was so amazing about that movie is even the most, I guess, sort of, there were a few more right-leaning people. There was a bit of a blend. But generally speaking, a lot of those guys from Shin Bet seem to be from that kind of part of the political spectrum. Every one of them, even the most militant and sort of old school, very pointedly at the end of the documentary, repeated their deeply held conviction that talks was everything. It was like, no matter how deep the divide, no matter how committed you are to sort of ensuring that your enemy remains your enemy, you have to get around the table. I thought that was one of the most amazing messages of that excellent film.
Yeah. Also, we should reference Saeb Erekat, who's been on this show, and he looked like he'd retired, but basically he's been completely instrumental in getting these talks going. So shout out to him, maybe.
Next story, Tom.
Well, there's another one I mentioned. I just thought another sort of divided state, quite interesting. The UN peacekeeping force in Cyprus, their mandate actually expires after, well, about half a century. It's had a couple of extensions already, but it's supposedly now going to actually lapse. And it's just really interesting because you talk about the snail's pace of progress in delivering on these kind of very complex and turbulent political divides. And it'll be interesting to see whether this is a largely symbolic thing, I suppose, but whether that actually will make any difference. I mean, there's a lot of people who have maintained a commitment to a reunification process there. And it'll be very interesting. That actually happens on Wednesday, the formal end of the UN peacekeepers. So just another one to sort of watch this week in you know, not too far away.
And again, an interesting kind of twist in the fact that, you know, maybe 20 years ago, the Turkish part was seen as impoverished and, you know, part of a poor old Turkey, and the Greeks were wealthy and part of the European Union. And now it's, you know, poor southern Cyprus has had this banking crisis, and the northern part is connected to kind of buoyant still Turkey.
Well, absolutely. And the other thing that's interesting is, of course, that UN peacekeeping force, you know, part of their mandate was a kind of a broad humanitarian responsibility. And so, yeah, the economic situation is so different from what it was, you know, going back to the 70s or longer ago than that. Yeah, really interesting to see exactly what will happen, and, you know, from midweek onwards.
Good. And the next?
Well, I thought one other political one. It's difficult not to sort of focus on this week, and we'll be doing that quite a lot on Monocle 24 a week, is to look at Zimbabwe. Again, on Wednesday, there's going to be a general election. Obviously, you've got quite staunch opposition to the whole process from the likes of Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai, but it's going to go ahead. And we'll be looking ahead to Wednesday and trying to sort of assess what will happen when the country goes to the polls and then reacting to it afterwards. It's obviously incredibly complex when you have these people who have these despotic tendencies and they call these elections, and there's a lot of dispute and disagreement, even just about how they're called and the manner in which they're convened, far less the actual outcomes. But we'll be looking ahead to that. We've got a lot of interesting features and interviews all during the week. So one we'll be following closely here on the station.
And did you have nothing fun this week?
Well, I just thought one final thing, which is happening tomorrow, which I thought I'd mention. You know, I'm a bit of a secret car enthusiast. I'm always very interested in developments.
I know. I saw you put your name down to a potential trip to the Frankfurt Motor Show. You're like,
I'd be all over that.
I could be available.
Exactly. Only because I'm sort of taking one for the team, Andrew. But interesting, one thing that's is really sort of changed a lot, and just in the last probably 5 years, is electric vehicles. It's for so long sort of suggested it would be, you know, the saviours to the motor industry. But they've never quite managed to gain the kind of traction, perhaps, with consumers and across the industry. But BMW, they're unveiling their... was sort of launching their i3 vehicle, which is a real potential game changer, not just for BMW, but for the whole of the sort of, you know, electric vehicle industry. There's obviously a few established players who they'll be going up against, but they're pitching into a sort of really interesting place in the marketplace. So there's a couple that are maybe a little cheaper, but this is delivering way more in terms of the technology and the potential. And whilst it's not at maybe Tesla levels of expense, it could just be exactly in the right marketplace for a lot of consumers. So there'll be a lot of people watching on how they get on. That's all happening from tomorrow.
Good. I can see that Sophie hasn't got a question about electric cars.
I have.
So, have you got one?
I have. Haven't electric cars...
How many batteries do they take?
...been around for absolutely eons?
Absolutely.
But they just haven't been developed. Why is that?
Well, I think there hasn't been enough lateral thinking, enough creative thinking about how you tackle some of the obvious limitations. Now, obviously, charging and distances attainable on electric cells still leave something to be desired. But a lot of the big manufacturers now are looking at things like partial sort of carbon exchange programs, where if you have journeys that your electric vehicle isn't quite up to doing on a single charge, you can actually sort of be lent a vehicle from a fleet of existing petrol-powered cars. So you can kind of supplement the activity and integrate it gradually into normal consumer usage. And I think what now people are thinking a bit more laterally about it, that could be the case cracker.
I bet you're the type of person at dinner parties that says, so, what car are you driving at the moment?
Never ask that, because I would never be invited to a dinner party. I just have to stand around back eating hand to mouth.
Well, Tom Edwards, if you were a little electric car, I'd say you're fully charged this week. Firing on all cylinders.
Excellent.
Very good. I'm going to give you 10 out of 10 because I actually mark the script each week when you come on.
Oh my God. Is that I'm assuming that's probably comfortably my best so far.
Yeah, that's the first time you've ever got anywhere near that mark.
Well, that's good.
Tom Edwards, news editor, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, Tom, you knocked that out of the park.
Thank you, Tom. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove. We head to China next, and the very ornate halls of power that have this week come under fire from the authorities in Beijing. That's right, after this. They are the palaces of power of a nation on the rise. Cutting-edge design, extravagant interiors. No expense has been spared, it seems, for the city halls, department office blocks and other organs of government. Until now, that is.
The good times for China's lavish government buildings are over, it seems. Banquets for visiting dignitaries have been outlawed. Red carpet receptions for government officials have also been prohibited. Now a ban on new government buildings has also come into force.
The ban, which was implemented this week, will be in place for the next 5 years. Yes, 5 years to stop city, local and national branches of government splashing out while the rest of the country is holding the purse strings tight.
Well, joining us now in the studio is Charles Fu, co-founder of the Office for Architectural Culture Practice here in London, and a person who has designed and built several government buildings across China.
Well, Charles, welcome to the show. And we're obviously here to talk about what's happening in China and this ban on the building of new government and public buildings. Why do you think they've decided to bring this in now?
To me, it's not a big surprise, because over the last 10, 15 years, China has been open to the international architectural community, if you like, and lots of foreign architects been designing buildings in China. And at the same time, a local architect tried to learn from that. And I think the reasons are, on one hand, the central government probably thought that they're spending too much on such buildings instead of on the infrastructure or the people. And also, they tend to oversize the buildings or space they need. So I think that they try to constrain the spending on this.
I mean, a lot of the buildings that have gone up, no one's really heard of. And we've all heard of the Bird's Nest and some of these big landmark towers that have sprung up in Shanghai. But actually, there are many more buildings springing up. And some buildings are replicas of European palaces and things like that. I wondered if you've seen any of these buildings and whether they have a kind of purpose, or are they more status structures in a way?
I've seen some of the buildings like that. And unfortunately, from my standpoint, I don't think it's a healthy thing. It's imitation or mimic. And on one hand, there are few good buildings here and there from time to time you see in China. But on the other hand, most of the new buildings try to copy what we have in the rest of the world, and without thinking what traditions they have and, you know, the roots.
Now, Charles, you've done some work in mainland China, architectural
yes.
work, and for public institutions as well.
Yes.
That process of, you know, of winning the contract and then dealing with the client, has that been a complicated process? Do you see actually some of the kind of risks involved actually that have led to this kind of ban? Do you find actually sometimes, you know, the client is asking for something that's beyond the scale of what they really need?
Yes, it's been quite complicated. Equally, if not more than what you would do in similar developing countries. Of course, you know, for public or state buildings or governmental buildings, there are a lot of government involvement. But in the same time, there, as a foreign architect to design a building in China, we need a local associate architect. So, but apart from that, lots of people, specialists like engineers and all the different people, are also involved too. So in terms of the professional process, it's not easy. But on the other hand, from people like us coming from outside into China, we don't quite know how they work. We know one or two, but not a whole of it. So the system they are used to work is quite different from what we're familiar with. For example, you know, they have a lot of, you know, socialist, former Soviet influences on top of the complicated Chinese traditional systems, so let alone the corruption and, you know, all these things.
And in terms of design, do you think the government is responding to a lack of thought that's been put into these buildings? I mean, there are too many of them, and obviously there some of the problems have been with corruption, but is this about halting a kind of runaway train of government buildings that don't actually have a real purpose and aren't necessarily designed fit for purpose because of that? Is it, it's a kind of a vicious circle in a way?
On one hand, I think, yes, I think that this policy is positive to stop tendency of making something more than what they need. And also, every single local authority tries to show how big their vision is and how big their structure is, which results in such buildings we're seeing now.
And I wanted to ask you, Charles, also, I guess what's interesting is that it'll be interesting to see how this ban actually works. I guess there's a huge amount of buildings already kind of being built, so there's going to be some time delay as those get finished. And then I guess the other thing is, you know, that there's a good thing about the breathing space as well. We've seen it with the high-speed rail projects as well, which they took a breather in a sense, because they knew that actually the pace at which things were being done were leading to kind of shortcuts and dangerous shortcuts. We saw some of the, you know, terrible incidents with the high-speed rail project. Do you think that part of it is also that they're thinking, okay, we need to kind of make sure these buildings are going up in a way that's safe and they're going to last? And also perhaps just kind of outward looking, we've already seen that the current Chinese presidency, very keen to kind of say to people, look, you know, we're not profligate. Say, you know, we're not kind of spending loads of money on banquets and things anymore. Do you think part of it is that they just don't want people kind of peering through the windows of City Hall and seeing vast chandeliers and marble floors as well?
I think that's obviously one of the reasons. I think the Chinese government is still trying to find a way out. On one hand, they're being attacked by people, you know, in terms of how they spend money. From my standpoint, I think as a society or a country, I think what's lacking in China is an organic growth. You know, everything is forced, everything is planned. And things like buildings or cities, you know, they're talking about urbanization. You can see everywhere in China, every single street is huge and the city blocks are huge. Therefore, buildings are huge. And which in a way kind of encourage people or governments to build something big, which is not the lesson we learned over the last half century, if not more.
Because I was speaking to an architect, American-German, in fact, who'd worked quite a lot in China. And she was saying, actually, she's fed up of working there because she has to go there, partner with a local firm. There's this very sort of unhappy marriage of the Western architect with the local contractor. It's very difficult for creative people from the States, for instance, to fit in with the culture of construction in China. Do you think we're seeing maybe a few architects turning away from that market and taking their business elsewhere?
I've heard some doing that, but to be honest, that kind of mode of working is universal around the world. You know, for example, you know, we are based in the UK and we asked to design a building in Russia, for example, which I've done something there too. We always need local associate architects and specialists. So it doesn't matter where you know, which country you design a building in, you have to do that. So to me, it's not unusual. It's not unusual, but you know, every country has its own traditions and system in terms of professions and engineering and architecture. We always need to adjust ourselves to suit what's needed there.
Charles Fu, architect of Beijing's tallest building and several government buildings across the People's Republic. Thank you very much for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly. Time for a little music now. It's been 4 years since Au Revoir Simone have released a full, proper-length album. But thankfully, this August, they're back. From the upcoming Move in Spectrums, this is their first single, Somebody Who.
That was Somebody Who by Au Revoir Simone, due for release on the 24th of August through Moshi Moshi. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Election Day in Zimbabwe is almost upon us. 5 years since the historic power-sharing deal between President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai, Monocle 24 assesses how the political landscape's changed since Election Day 2008 and what's at stake for the country and the continent in this year's vote. From the economy to the arts to freedom of speech, we'll unpick the key issues at play as Zimbabweans head to the polls. Zimbabwe Votes, a series of special reports, all next week, here on Monocle 24.
Surf's up this summer as Monocle Films follows the wind in search of an under-the-radar beach haven for diehard enthusiasts.
Ericeira is special for its wide array of waves. Beach breaks, point breaks, and reef breaks to suit a range of surfing styles and skill levels, all in a compact span of dramatic coastline. This 8-kilometer stretch of coast was named a World Surfing Reserve in 2011, and the surfers who come here can't stop raving about it.
Catch the wave in Ericeira in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, and Sophie Grove. Curiosity, the old adage goes, killed the cat. Well, poking your nose in might be a perilous business, especially for our feline friends. But for the rest of us, an inquiring mind might in fact mean we live longer and lead more successful lives.
That's according to Professor Ian Robertson of Trinity College Dublin. Well, this and other topics are being explored at the Festival of Curiosity, which starts today in Dublin. Joining us on the line now are Vincent McCarthy, co-founder and CEO of the Festival of Curiosity, and Ian Robertson, Professor of Psychology at Trinity College Dublin and author of The Winner Effect, The Science of Success.
Vince, obviously you're Vincent rather. I'm shortening your name already. We don't even know each other. We haven't even had a drink together. But Vincent, let me ask you, obviously, you know, you've been the co-founder of this festival. What made you decide that it was time to do it?
Well, the Festival of Curiosity is a legacy from Dublin being designated a City of Science last year. Dublin won the bid to host the Euroscience Open Forum, which was Europe's largest general science conference. As part of that, we had over 200 events with over 600,000 people attending these arts and cultural events, all used to promote science. And there was such a great energy behind it. There was such great enthusiasm for it. We decided that it needed to keep going. There needed to be a legacy. So we created a vision for a new idea for a new festival called the Festival of Curiosity to create a culture of curiosity here in Dublin and Ireland over the next 10 years, because we believe curiosity is the first step towards inquiring and engaging with the world around you and hopefully using science to answer those questions that you might have.
Now, Vincent, before I let Sophie get another word in edgeways, could you just tell me, do you think that people are more or less curious than used to be? Because in some senses, I guess, you know, the internet, those things have allowed us to go on journeys every evening as we sit at home, kind of maybe with a working away. Suddenly you think, oh, I wonder what happened to Blue, you know, 20 years ago, or I wonder what happened to that person. But in other ways, I guess that kind of closes us down. We've lost the serendipitous kind of journey you used to get through newspapers, for example, where you might pick up the newspaper because you're a business reader, but suddenly find yourself on the sports page. Do you think the world is pushing us to be more or less curious?
You're right in that respect. In some respects, our curiosity has been piqued by the internet and being able to get easy information and things like that. But ultimately, one of the things that I think we're maybe lacking nowadays is the curiosity to see a question, see a challenge and go for the answer. We might not even know the answer, or might be able to get the answer to it. So the process of looking for it in a novel way can actually help us and is better for us. But we're trying to hark back to the original kind of curiosity that people like Christopher Wren would have had years ago when they set up the Royal Society and places like that. Like, they're inquiring and probing these areas in your own life or what you might be interested in a deeper way, and hopefully trying to get answers for yourself and maybe someone else as well.
And Ian, I wondered, following on from Andrew's question, whether you could talk about how the perception of curiosity, rather, has changed, because some people have thought of it as sort of nosing around in other people's business. But then there's also a more cerebral side to knowledge and curiosity. But I wondered how that's shifted and whether or not it's becoming more of a positive thing.
Well, personally, I think that the internet and the social media, even though there's an upside and a downside, an upside is there is lots of information there about which you can ask yourself questions, and you're bombarded with new things, and novelty is the food of curiosity. If at least got some orientation towards asking questions, novelty, like curiosity, switches on the front part of our brain. The downside, I guess, is the bite-sized chunks in which information tends to come now. You know, the 140 character tweet or the brief entries. Curiosity sometimes, often for the big advances and big discoveries, requires us to sustain our attention over time, to follow through a question and to say, well, if that's true, what follows from that? That is the essence of scientific thinking and of innovation. And so there's a risk that while we're exposed to an awful lot more new things and there's much more information to feed our curiosity, the risk is that our attention spans are declining in a way that means we can't maybe sometimes go as deep as we should do to get the really fundamental discoveries.
Professor, I wanted to also ask you, do you think that in some senses curiosity is something of a luxury? I wonder whether you think of the you know, 200 years ago, 300 years, the kind of the scientists of that time, they were often kind of gentlemen scientists. They were kind of thinking about, you know, exploring. They had a kind of, there's money probably behind them. And even today, the people who are allowed to be curious to think, I wonder what it's like to go to India, or I wonder what. You kind of need to have some kind of privilege in a way, don't you, to be curious?
Yes, I mean, you think the drones should not be curious. Well, I think that the nature of the advanced societies that we live in is such that we know that the more educated people are, the better our economies do, the better our health is. So education is the critical driver of our advanced economies. And the level of work and the level of engagement that the average person has is so much higher now than it was in the times when they were maybe labouring incuriously in the fields. So I think that is part of our evolution as a civilised society, that more people become more curious, more people have the opportunity to come up with new ideas. And there again, I think the internet, the growth of social media, offers an opportunity for people to come up with new ideas as groups, if you like, of crowdsourcing, that kind of thing. So I definitely don't think it's one of these things that should be the realm of the privileged few.
Do you think you can teach curiosity in schools? Is there a way of nurturing a more curious child and a brain than there a modern way of sort of drawing out the curious mind?
There's actually evidence you can do that. And the evidence is if you do that, then you get improvements, not just in creativity and curiosity, but across the board in academic subjects. This research was done in London several years ago, and they did it just for an hour a week in the course of a science course. And what they did was they put a whole lot of objects and things and materials onto a table, and they asked the pupils to learn to ask questions about these things. They asked them to say, well, how many ways, different ways, could you group or categorize these very different objects? What questions would you ask yourself about these categorizations? And that is really stimulating children, these were adolescents, into doing what's the greatest achievement of the human mind, which is to ask good questions. And when they did that just an hour a week for over about a year, when they came to the GCSE scores of these groups, their GCSE scores across subjects, not just in science, were significantly higher.
Now, Vincent, before we wrap up, could you just tell us a couple of the things that you know will be in the festival, things that people might want to come and see?
So the Festival of Curiosity is taking place in July here in Dublin City. There's a lot of different things on. So, for example, there's a science treasure hunt across the city where people have to follow riddles and clues, and they can understand more about their city and see it maybe with a different lens through science and technology that they mightn't have seen before. There's also a lot of different types of exhibitions. There's Illusion here in the Science Gallery, which is a family exhibition talking all about the illusory nature of visual stimuli and things like that, which are really good as well for the family. We have a mini maker fair here in Dublin. It's the second year it's been here. So that's to the maker movement, where people really get to touch, play and interact with things. And we've our very own Curiosity Carnival. So that's Ireland's first interactive science playground. And that's for people to come in again and play and touch and feel and maybe make and break things and maybe invent something that they haven't invented before.
Okay, and just before we let you both go, can I ask you, Vincent, are you a curious person?
I am indeed. I'll tell you how I did physics and maths myself in college, and how I started out on this journey of curiosity was looking up at the stars and wondering what's out there and could we reach there and all these questions. Maybe I'll never get to answer myself, but that was my start of my journey, and it's led me to this point at the moment.
That was the very curious Vincent McCarthy, co-founder and CEO of the Festival of Curiosity, and Ian Robertson, professor of psychology at Trinity College Dublin and author of The Winner Effect, The Science of Success. Are you curious, Sophie?
You have to be in this job.
Oh, look at that. That could be your motto.
Yeah, it could be. You have to be not quite rifling around in people's bins, but you definitely have to be thinking, ooh, what's that all about?
Now, I was very worried, though, that he said that, you know, to be properly curious, you needed to have a good attention span.
Yeah.
Oddly, I do think that even when you try not to kind of be caught up in this kind of, you know, glazing over world where you're kind of like looking at your phone one minute, you know, book the next, you know, TV screen the next, it's very hard not to kind of be caught up in the moment and the instant thing rather than having time to delve and to discover.
Exactly. It's quite interesting that you can actually really give your brain a workover by just thinking really hard and being very curious. I like the idea of that, really.
And I wondered why curiosity did kill the cat.
Because it jumped off and, you know, it got itself into a pickle, essentially. Okay.
Pickled cat. No one would want that.
Coming up next, we examine the inky etchings of some American artists.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made Radar Week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian. The shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well. It has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Whether you're in the midst of a busy business day in Europe or eating your cereal on the East Coast, The Briefing sets you up with a fast-paced mix of news and views that you won't find anywhere else.
It's a very beautiful phone, I think. It's not out till next month. That's the only phone outside of HTC at this moment.
This one I'm holding?
Yes.
No wonder we've got security.
We'll bring you the latest developments in aviation, technology, defense, retail, and media with our industry experts, a rundown of the US and Latin American papers, plus a sharp business review of the day.
It really came about with us saying, you know, this would make sense to do something that we would enjoy shopping at and kind of change the retail landscape a little bit.
So tune in to The Briefing every day at midday London time, 7 a.m. in New York.
Handwriting. A distant memory stolen by the keyboard. Our elegant script has been infiltrated by plastic buttons, stripping us of a unique element of our individuality and creativity.
Hours of lessons at school learning to perfect one's script seem wasted as we bash away at our keyboards. An inky impression of oneself etched onto a page is more than just a group of words, but a depiction of our personality.
Well, an exhibition at the Archives of American Art displaying letters written by 42 American artists shows us that an artist might put pen to paper just as they would apply a line to a drawing.
Well, joining us on the line now from Washington, D.C. is Mary Savig, curator of the exhibition at the Archives of American Art. Mary, hi. Why did you decide to put this exhibition together?
Well, we just had sort of a moment of realization one day when we were talking about really recognizable artist handwriting. His name is Ad Reinhardt, and he writes with this calligraphic script. And we were talking at work about how you could notice his handwriting sort of a mile away. That sort of raised the conversation of people who are really familiar with certain artists in our collections become so familiar with their handwriting that we thought that this would be a good way to engage visitors through a museum exhibition.
Now, we often hear about what handwriting says about somebody's, you know, personality. There's obviously people who make a lot of money through going into companies and looking at people's handwriting and claiming that people are either not or are suitable for hiring or not. Is that part of what people will be looking at, do you think, when they look at these handwriting examples? Do you think they're going to be looking for the artist that kind of veers slightly towards craziness and the other ones which were perhaps more upright and correct than you might imagine?
Yeah, actually, part of our approach was inspired by graphology, which is the study of letters, to sort of imagine someone's personality based on their handwriting. We wanted to make it a little bit more historically based, so for each of the letters in the exhibition, we had a really prominent art historian who was familiar with the artist's biography and their works to comment on the handwriting. So we did have someone who was an expert look at the handwriting in a way that they might look at the artist's paintings and sculptures. And sometimes it did relate to their personality. If it was someone who was known for a more abstract expressionist style, you know, often their handwriting wasn't super upright or neat. Or if it was, for example, Carl Andre, he's a minimalist artist who was known for working with squares and grids and sculptures. And his handwriting is very grid-like. The letters are very neatly organized, and he doesn't have cursive flares or fanciful swirls in his handwriting. So it was an approach of a graphologist that did inspire.
You kindly sent us some examples of the exhibition, from the exhibition, and there's a postcard here written by Carl André. He's a fond of the capital letter as well. It's all kind of very kind of blocky, as you say. It's very neat, and you can actually read what he wants to say.
Yes, it's very clear, and his artwork is very relatable. So I think that's a really great example of how the art historian who was writing about Carl André could correlate his everyday life and practice of even writing something as simple as a postcard to his art practice.
And do you think that some of these artists saw their handwriting as an expression of self or even an artwork in itself? I'm looking at Dan Flavin's letter here. It's incredibly intricate and calligraphic. Quite a surprise for such a minimalistic guy, he of the famous light rods. His writing is almost of 18th century.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites because, as you said, Dan Flavin was in the same cohort of artists as the Carl André postcard, but his handwriting does look like something from the 19th century. And that was something that he cultivated. He looked at the works of and the writing of 19th century artists, landscape artists in particular, and he tried to really work on that script. The the art historian who wrote the label for that particular letter, who worked on his catalog, Raisonné, she did say that in his diaries every day he would practice his scripts, so it did look like it had this 19th century look to it, aesthetic. So yeah, a lot of artists did really work on their handwriting because it was, when letters were such a primary way for people to communicate with each other, handwriting was really more significant than it is now.
Mary, one of the ones that I quite like, because it's surprising, is Jackson Pollock. Now, oddly, he writes like a kind of Victorian gent. It's kind of very elegant and nicely poised. It doesn't kind of really remind you of his art. Well, it doesn't me, anyway.
Oh, that's interesting. I think his handwriting is...
Does interesting mean you think I'm wrong?
Well, no, I don't think you're wrong. I think that's what's the appeal to this exhibition, is everyone sort of sees something else in the handwriting. Jackson Pollock was writing at a time where his penmanship maybe should have been a little bit more worked on, I guess. It is a little sloppy compared to a lot of people of his generation. And the art historian who wrote about him said that he did travel a lot through the West as a child, and so he didn't learn proper penmanship in school. So his handwriting is a little bit quirky in that he didn't learn the rigors of writing every single letter as one would have at the time.
Is there a sense that this exhibition is a bit disarming for some of the artists? I mean, they're artists for a reason, and some of their writing looks very naive, and some of them really look like children in a way when you look at their script. I'm looking at Jim Nutt's letter here to a friend, and it's, you know, punctuated with little kind of speech bubbles and funny little drawings, but really there's a problem with spelling, and really it looks like he's almost struggling to write.
Yeah, well, Jim Nutt, his art is similar in a way that it does have this sense of modesty or playfulness to it. And that was part of his persona, and is part of his persona. He's still an artist who works in Chicago. Yeah, and I think it, just as his art is meant to be disarming, as you said, I think he really cultivated a handwriting that also has this sensibility to it, as a marker of his individuality, just as his paintings are an indication of that.
Did it make you feel a little bit sad in a way? Because if you tried to do this in 20 years' time for the contemporary artist, you'd be kind of sticking a load of emails up on the wall.
Yeah, I think that was one. This seemed like a very timely exhibition for us because, especially in the United States, I don't know how it is in other countries, but handwriting is taken out of the curriculum of many primary schools today. So there will be a time when people don't know how to even read cursive or sign their names in cursive, let alone write a letter in cursive. So we do hope that this sort of is curious to younger generations because they see how important handwriting was or important letter writing was as a form of communication. And we also hope, you know, people who are of older generations who handwriting was a part of their everyday lives for so long before email, that there's a sense of nostalgia or reminding them of different ways of communication.
Well, I think we can fairly say that actually within our office there's quite a few people who have some of the most shocking handwriting going.
Including Andrew, I just like to
including
add.
Yours truly, I'm afraid.
I know, mine is terrible. I think if I had a graphologist analyze mine, I would not be employable.
Mary Savig, curator of the Art of Handwriting at the Archives of American Art in Washington. Thank you very much for joining us here on the Monocle Weekly. Before we move on, Sophie, have you got good handwriting or bad handwriting?
I consider it to be good. It's very squiggly. Some people ask me if I'm writing code.
Mine looks like I'm drunk.
As you're our editor, we do have to decipher this handwriting to look at the marks on some of the pages that we see. And sometimes it is tricky.
I don't know what's happened to it. It used to be okay and it's gone downhill. Maybe it is because I'm on the keyboard too often.
I think it's the privilege of an editor to be able to kind of write in a very artful way all over the pages.
But when you look back, you know, when you think of your grandparents and your parents, I think when I think of my parents, if I see just like two or three words written by my mum or dad, it kind of takes you straight back to their kind of like my mum's endless shopping list or my dad kind of annotating stamps in his stamp collection. There's like a script and an elegance to it, which I think they would have.
And a beauty. I mean, my grandmother used to send letters from Australia on this absolutely such thin sort of airmail paper, and she'd write on both sides. You could hardly see what it was. It's this almost Victorian style of writing, so beautiful, which you just never see anymore.
Airmail letters, that was a good thing, because people wrote in such tiny script trying to fit as much onto this piece of paper that was like gossamer.
And it was like an absolute, it was like a Rizzler. The paper was so thin and delicate, but I don't get many of those anymore. More like emails.
Yes.
She hasn't quite mastered those though. So.
Well, we get plenty of those. What a curious show we've had.
We have, curiouser and curiouser.
Nicely handwritten, the whole script.
I know, beautiful. Where did you learn that calligraphy, Thomas?
I think that's Thomas Lewis. Beautiful handwritten script. I've never seen one before. Oh, I'm going to cherish that.
That's a Welsh education for you, isn't it?
I know. And Barbara, she was very helpful.
She was.
Shout and cues. She'd be a very good prompter in the theatre, I think.
She would, terrifyingly so. You really have to be bold as a prompter.
Yes. Now, I did like the handwriting examples. You want to take them home, don't you?
I do. I'm fascinated by Dan Flavin because he's such an iconoclast. And then there he is with his very elegant, ladylike handwriting.
It was funny when somebody really, really disagrees with you. She pretended she kind of understood my point.
Like, interesting.
Interesting. That meant you're so not on the right page here, mate.
She meant wrong.
Yeah, she meant wrong. I'm sorry. Well, that's the way it goes.
It's open for interpretation.
Anyway, we've had a very nice show. I think it's been quite highbrow for us. Tom Edwards dragged it down a little bit into the gutter, as he normally does.
We'll
but apart from that, it was quite highbrow.
It was. I enjoyed it hugely. Educating our readers and our listeners, rather, and ourselves.
Mainly ourselves, actually, I think, to be honest. But we're the ones that need it. Well, that's all for this edition, 212th edition even, of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis and Barbara Feeney, and our studio manager was Jack Phillips. We'll be here again next week at the same time, so please do join us then. But until then, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Tuck.
And me, Sophie Grove.
Thank you for listening.